This is a download from Triple J.
For more music, current affairs, comedy and culture, triplej.net.au.
And now...
Triple J.
Triple J.
Triple J.
Triple J Mornings with Zan.
This morning we are chatting with the Queen of the... King of the Science Airwaves, Dr. Carl.
I embrace all genders because all is one.
It's the end of the year. Things are getting muddled in my head. Good morning, Dr. Carl. It's your final science talkback hour for 2011. How are you feeling?
Happy and sad. Very happy to be going away, but very sad to be leaving all my new best friends. But we did do a blogcast on drcarl.com to cover the podcast that won't be happening.
Oh, great.
So we got this cast that'll be going, so there'll be 8 weeks of sciencey goodness, but it's not the same as the POTS or plain old telephone system that love when people talk on the radio.
Well, if you are missing Dr. Carl, you can, of course, catch up on drcarl.com or download a whole bunch of the last few podcasts on the Triple J website to tide you over. Today, though, get in your questions. If there's one that's been bugging you all year, today is the day to call us, 1300 055 36. Let's jump straight into it, Carl.
Yep.
Tim's calling in from Mount White in Sydney. Hi, Tim.
How you going?
Great. What's your question?
Just wondering, whenever I put headphones in to listen to some music and it's all well and good, sounds fine, and when I take them out from a distance, the pitch actually sounds like it drops a little. I'm just wondering if that's right or why that is.
Okay, so can you just explain that last bit? From a distance, it seems that the pitch drops a little. Can you just take us through that?
Yeah, when they're right in my ears, like when I put the headphones right in my ears, like everything sounds fine, and then when I actually pull them out, you can still sort of hear the music. But, yeah, the pitch sort of just drops just slightly. It just sounds like it's a little bit lower.
Ooh. I'm confused about this one. This is as complicated as biking and textiles and the universe. on one hand, when the headphones are flush against your head... Oh, question. Are they open-air headphones, which just sit on the ear, or are they the wraparound ones that have a cushion and make a relatively airtight seal?
Yeah, they're the ones that just sort of sit flush in your ear.
So earbuds, pretty much.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. Look, we'll have to wait for... have you got an answer? Is there any geeky person in Triple J that knows that?
I'm not sure.
Where's Cam? Where's Linda? Where's the people in Master Control?
Well, hopefully they're listening around the office and they'll come running in to save us.
There'd be some sort of impedance effect where as they're going further away, you don't have the coupling of the ear bud with the ear canal.
Okay.
But I don't know which way the physics would go to make it higher in frequency or lower in frequency, whereas these guys, they'd know all that stuff off the back of their... Yeah, easy. Come on, Linda.
Hang around. Lockie, our awesome super producer behind the phones, has left his post to run and see if he can find them. We'll see if we can find out for you, Tim, the answer very, very soon. Let's head to... See you, mate. Thanks for the call.
Thanks, guys.
Lauren's on the line from North Melbourne this morning. G'day, Lauren.
Hi.
What's your question?
My question is, sometimes when I use an elevator or a lift, hours later, I still feel like I'm going up the elevator.
Ah, is this disconcerting? Does it make you a little dizzy, a bit spinny?
Yeah, sometimes I feel a bit faint and just all over the shop.
Has it been like this for a long time, or is this just over the last couple of weeks or months or years?
I just noticed it because I never really use elevators when I've been on holidays in the last year. I've noticed that. Yeah, if I'm using it, like, more than 3 or 4 times a day, it will happen.
Look, as our old friends we talk about every 2 weeks, the little bony crystals in the ear that float in liquid and touch against hairs and act as little accelerometers to let you know which way you are standing. They work as both static and dynamic motion sensors. And it could be that they're just changing in shape from the beloved and desirable, perfectly spherical to something a little messier, like square or like a peanut shell. And it could be that one morning you'll head off for wake up and then just stand up and then immediately fall down and start vomiting and be stuck with benign positional vertigo, BPV, for the next 5 years and it'll go away by itself.
Jeepers.
Yeah, almost certainly it'll all go away by itself. There are little complicated things happening. If we had the money and if we had the technology, we could actually do high-resolution MRI scans of each of your ears, which is where the balance centres are, and we could probably find something there. Or it might be something to do with the nervous wiring up inside the brain where the balance centres are.
Okay.
But almost certainly it will not go bad. Only a case, there's a very small chance it will, but the odds are way, way, way in your favour that it won't go missy on you. And what's causing it? Either something neural or the little bony crystals.
All right, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Lauren. Hey, we're going to go back to Tim in Mount White, or at least answer his question. We do have some help from our incredibly talented live music team. Linda from our live music team says, it's the Doppler effect, Dr. Carl. The length of the waveforms are changing as they travel away from your ear.
That's part of it? Wow.
She also said she will absolutely not come on air. So this is the reason why our live music team are so good, because they're not distracted by being superstars on air. They're too busy making music sound wonderful behind the scenes. Thank you very much, Linda, for dropping in with that question. Jono's calling in from Horsham this morning with a question. G'day, Jono.
G'day, Dr. Carl and Dr. Zan.
You sound like you're on the side of the road, Jono. Are you near the giant koala in Horsham?
Oh, about 100 metres past it.
Sweet. Wow, so it's like I'm your own GPS. What's your question?
I actually had a question about my partner and I are 27 weeks pregnant, and we went through IVF to gain our pregnancy. And we were wondering what factors can determine the sex of our baby. Like, we know that going through IVF can increase the chances slightly, and I have a brother who's had a son first, and I have two sisters who had females first. So we're wondering what other factors can determine the sex.
Looking at the overall scale, in every 1,000 newborn children, there are 30 more boys. But the male of the species is a little bit weaker, and a few more boys than girls die in that first year of life. It's nature's way of compensating so the world ends up with a roughly equal mix. But then there are other factors such as hormones. Back in the 30s, and not today, let me emphasise, but back in the 30s, the beef farmers did not feed hormones to their cattle to feed them up quickly, and then the butchers' wives were giving birth to kids in the same ratio as everybody else, 106 boys for 103 girls. That was in the 30s. In the 70s, we're talking America here, there was lots of tender hormone-rich meat on display in the butcher shops. Yep. And the butchers were soaking up the female sex hormones straight through their skin as they carved up the cuts, and their wives were having more girls than boys.
Mm.
Now, to tap the balance even further, butchers eat more meat than the rest of us. If there is a vegetarian butcher, my daughter's a vegetarian, for example. If there's a vegetarian butcher out there somewhere in the world, can you ring in? We'll give you a Triple J fun pack. I can't believe that.
I'm pretty sure there's no way that there is a vegetarian butcher in the world. I'm happy to be proved wrong.
Yeah, I'm happy to be proved wrong too. So butchers eat more meat than the rest of us, and so a butcher 20 years ago was saturated with female sex hormones, and some of the butchers even grew breasts. But then it changed the other way in the 80s when the farmers found that new artificial male hormones would make the cattle grow even fatter and faster. And so it changed from female to male sex hormones. And in the 1990s, American, not Australian, American butchers' wives were having 121 boys for every 100 girls. And so you mentioned quite rightly, Jono, the genetic factor. And there are environmental factors such as the hormones. And you can do the thing where you get the sperm, and the boy-making sperms are a little bit weaker than the girl-making sperms. And so you put them in a centrifuge and you separate them out that way, and then you introduce them on around a coffee table or something to the egg. And then
over a bottle of wine.
Bottle of wine and everything. But then that gets complicated too, because the latest studies are showing that men who are obese at the time that they manufactured the sperm, and sperm have got a 72-day life roughly, they will give birth to girls who are more likely to become diabetic and boys who are likely to become fat. So really you shouldn't love another person very much if you want to make babies as a result of wine or drugs or obesity. It's so tricky.
There's so much going on, as always, in this answer, Dr. Carl. But I think Jono's got a bit of an idea, a few different paths to take. And, of course, he's 100 metres away from a not-to-scale koala in Horsham. So life's good for Jono.
Thanks so much for the call, mate. Thanks for a great year, Dr. Carl.
Cheers, Jono.
Right.
Triple J's Like a Virgin 7. 23 your favourite acts playing versions of their favourite Christmas songs.
No, they're not Christmas songs, just covers of normal songs.
Allies does Jingle Bells.
No, she did Pumped Up Kicks.
Art vs. Science, Duke, another Christmas track.
No, they did a Daft Punk track.
Sarah Blasco plays Good King Wenceslas.
She did Hey Ya by Outkast.
And that's just a Christmas start. Deck your halls with Triple J's Like a Virgin 7.
It has nothing to do with Christmas.
I didn't say anything about Christmas. It's available at ABC shops, record shops, Triple J website shop, and from Santa Claus at Christmas.
Thank you, Sam Simmons. Sam here with you. Dr. Carl joining us. He's very silly, isn't he, Dr. Carl?
Is that Naked Sam?
That's Naked Sam. For anybody who doesn't know that reference, 24 hours of Sam Simmons is what we all experienced on the radio a few months ago, and it happened on a Thursday, which meant that Dr. Carl shared the studio with Sam Simmons. We didn't tell him that Sam would be naked for the whole of Science Hour. And you handled it very well. You didn't literally handle it very well, Dr. Carl, but you took it very well.
But the thing I'm
just going to stop talking now.
But I did love his reference to the koalas needing to, the mummy and daddy koalas needing to make sure that their babies had a good gut with good bacteria by making sure that they ate daddy's mummy and mummy and daddy's poo. And this is not something that humans should do.
No.
But specifically for koalas, or koalas as they call them in America, yes.
Yes, also known as the Scat versus Pat moment, which is, has been podcast on the Mornings blog if you want to track it down. It is 7 minutes of golden listening. We are talking science for the last time this year, 1300 055 36, if you've got a question for Dr. Carl. George in Richmond does. Morning, George.
Hi, Zan. I'm Dr. Carl.
Hi. What's your question?
Well, wondering about dogs' paws on hot pavements, and does a dog feel the hot pavement like we do?
They would have to. I do not know for sure, and the way you would find out is by looking at experiments where you've had dogs and then you put them on hot metal floors in a study and you just crank it up and the dogs go, ouch, I want to get out of here. Now, I do know that with regard to dogs, they live, especially the baby dogs, in a different microenvironment. So you can be walking on a warmish summer's day and the dog, 10, 20 centimetres off the ground, is breathing in air that is much, much hotter. And they are close to respiratory failure. They're breathing in a very moist, very hot air, whereas you, 1.5 metres up higher, are breathing a completely different air. And I would, working on just basic physiology, that every creature has to have feedback about things that can harm them. They would have to have heat sensors in their feet. If the pavement is hot enough to burn your feet, it'll be hot enough to burn their feet. It's not as though they've got some sort of magical titanium super insulator of ceramic and unobtainium and graphene and carbonite. Yeah. Mate, they're just living flesh like us. We've got to treat them nice. Yeah.
Thanks for the call, George.
Thank you, Dr. George.
I would like unobtainium feet, Dr. Carl, just quietly. Daniel's calling in from Newcastle. Hi, Daniel.
Dr. Daniel, welcome.
Daniel, are you with us?
Daniel from Newcastle?
Oh, I think we've lost Daniel. Let's see if we can go to George. He's calling in from Markula. Hi, George.
Actually, Joel.
Oh, Joel. Sorry. You know what? George was the last caller we had.
And this, our brain
and this is why I'm going on holidays after tomorrow. Sorry about that, Joel. What's your question?
That's okay. I actually have an answer for you. First of all, before I say the main answer I was calling about, a couple of weeks ago you were mentioning about epinephrine and adrenaline and why they're called different things.
Yeah, why are they called different things? In Australia, they're adrenaline, and in America, they're epinephrine.
Yeah, it's because this is what my physiology lecturer told me, but when adrenaline was synthesized, they named it adrenaline without an E. And so the Americans didn't want, they thought that would be confusing, so they changed the name of the naturally occurring one rather than the one that they just made. So that's why they call it epinephrine, so as to not confuse the artificially made adrenaline.
So the Americans made up this name for synthetic adrenaline.
No, for real adrenaline, and because whoever made the artificial one called it adrenaline also, but they spelt it without an E. Because, you know, adrenaline has an E on the end of it.
Ah.
So, yeah.
They made it up. Okay.
Yeah. The main answer I had for you was about 9 months ago, there was a question on why do you become dehydrated when you drink alcohol if it's mostly water.
Yeah, beer is 95% water. Why would it make you dehydrated?
Well, I called in and told you that it was because of antidiuretic hormone, which gets turned off by alcohol, and you told me to find a peer-reviewed article to support that.
Did you find
it? I did. It was published in the Journal of Alcohol and Alcoholism last year, and this study was actually done more to investigate the hydration status and then the effects of that. But it also, the study they did had a group of people, and then they gave them 1,000 milliliters of non-alcoholic beer on two occasions, and they measured their urine. They controlled all the variables with telling them what to drink and eat and when and everything. And then they gave them 960 mils of the same non-alcoholic beer with 40 mils of ethanol. And they compared the two, and there was an average of 158 mils difference over a four-hour observational period. So the non-alcoholic group had 1,121 mils, and the one that had alcohol had 1,279 mils over 4 hours.
So you got a rough balance. You drink 1,000 mils of water, and you come out with, say, 1,120 mils, but you drink 1,000 mils of beer equivalent, and you come out with the 1,121 plus another 150 mils on top of that. So you're actually so you're 20% down. You've drunk 1,000 mils, and you've urinated out 1,200.
Yeah, so that's why you have one of the reasons why you're dehydrated in the morning.
So even though it's a small quantity of alcohol, only 5%, it turns on via various physiological pathways involving our good friend ADH, antidiuretic hormone, it makes you urinate 20% more than you drink.
Yeah.
Wow.
I think Joel needs a fun pack.
You need a fun pack. And if you could email me that paper through
Twitter,
or the link to it, I'd be ever so thrilled. And give me your address, and when I get back from the Antarctic, I'll send you a special little present as well.
Hey, something from Antarctica, Dr. Carl, is that what you're alluding to? He's going to bring you back a block of ice, Joel.
We actually did go and chip off some ice off an iceberg and used it in the scotch.
I was going to say.
Oh, would you like some scotch, Fearmouth?
Oh, what a
life
you
lead. Yes, of course, Bunting. And then you could hear it exploding because it was 10,000-year-old ice, and it had been compressed all that time, and the little bubbles were going crack, crack, crack as it was exploding. It was wonderful.
I love that you chilled your scotch with Antarctic ice. Only you, Dr. Carl. Joel, stay on the line. We'll get your details, and we'll hook you up with Dr. Carl. Thanks so much for checking out that study and even more for following up and calling us back. Good on you, mate.
No worries.
Let's cross now to Anthea, who's calling in from South Yarra with an interesting question. Hi, Anthea.
Hello, Zan. Hello, Dr. Carl.
Hello.
Dr. Anthea, welcome.
Hello. I'm very impressed with the Antarctic ice.
He lives the high life, Anthea. He lives the high life.
I know.
Or the cold life.
Yes, the exciting life. Dr. Carl, my question for you today is often when you get tired, in fact, recently my work colleagues and I had to work some really long hours and very late in the studio, and we were all very tired, and we just started to find the silliest things funny. And when we all started talking about why is it when you're tired you often become, you know, everything becomes silly and funny, and that you'd find in a normal day it wouldn't be as funny.
What do you reckon, Zan?
I don't know. There's definitely something about being delirious that just makes you laugh at stupid things. Is it something about, I don't know, severe tiredness making you weaker, making you less likely to
be rational?
Yeah, maybe it's something about rationality.
But our rationality can be hinged so easily. For example, I was reading a paper that I'm now going to quietly segue away from being unable to answer a question to picking a question that I can answer, close brackets. I was just accidentally reading a paper the other day in the Quarterly Journal of Experimental Psychology, and I was talking about how it's the act of entering a room through a doorway that makes you forget what you were going to do, or forget what you're going to get, or forget you're going to find. And they did a bunch of experiments in both real, you know, and virtual computer environments where they got people to do memory tasks or pick up things and put them into a box, and either they're doing it in the same room or going through a doorway. And then they had them even going in a complete loop through a whole bunch of rooms and coming back. And the point is that we are so irrational. And my daughter has done this. She's walked into the kitchen, and she's walked up and said, "I don't know why I'm here." And I'm so glad that it's a young person rather than somebody middle-aged like my boring self who can forget what she's doing. And it's the doorway. So maybe you can do an experiment where you get rid of all the doorways when you're tired.
Do you really think
in a big igloo.
That relates to that is a ridiculous experiment, Dr. Carl.
But luckily, when they're tired, they'll think it's quite rational.
Yeah.
Man, it's the doorways that are stopping us from discovering what we want to do and becoming famous and discovering the secret to the universe. All we have to do is get rid of doorways in buildings and then the secrets of the universe will be open to us. We'll never forget what you're doing because the act of going through the doorway acts as an event boundary in the mind, and it separates episodes of activity, and it puts them in different places. I don't know why being really tired makes you funny.
I think Dr. Carl's been drinking scotch with Antarctic ice. Maybe
sorry,
not.
I don't know.
But we're going to see if anybody else has an idea of why supreme tiredness makes you laugh at things that aren't necessarily that funny, that delirium that sets in. Happens to me as well. I'd love to know the answer too. Anthea, we'll see if we can find out in the next half hour. Thanks for the call, mate.
Thank you.
Edwin's calling in from Lillipilly this morning. Hi, Edwin.
How's it going? Great. Dr. Carl, Dr. Zan.
What's your
Dr.
question, Edwin?
Welcome.
My question was regarding magnetic fields and coil guns. I remember in first year university electromagnetism, they told you that a magnetic field would change the direction of a moving particle, such as like in the Large Hadron Collider. But then it had me thinking, then how does a coil gun or rail gun work where you're accelerating like a projectile using a magnetic field?
You've got shifting magnetic fields. It's a variation on a linear motor. It's like an ordinary motor, except you run it around in a full circle. You get a circular motor, and then you cut it with a hacksaw, and you lay it flat. And then you have the magnetic impulses both pulling and then pushing as you go along. Now, I'm going to quote Wikipedia on this with regard to the following. I have not looked up Wikipedia to get the answer. And in fact, Wikipedia is moderately good for the answers, but terrific in the references. But I reckon if you look up, what do you call it? I call them a rail gun. You called it a coil gun?
Yeah, I just remember like when I was younger, people liked to make coil guns out of like some copper wiring and put like a little nail inside it.
Yeah. Well, you don't want to make weapons.
No.
But look up linear motor, rail gun, coil gun on both Wikipedia and How Stuff Works, and one of them will probably have an explanation with pictures. You need the pictures. But basically, as something's going along, you repel it at one stage and suck it at another stage, and sometimes you do both and you have different magnets all the way along. And by the way, with a Large Hadron Collider, to keep that beam, which is thinner than the diameter of a hair, which is travelling at 99.999991 something percent of the speed of light, and which goes around a 27-kilometre circle, to keep it accurate to within the spatial parameter of thinner than a human hair, they have 30,000 tonnes of magnets. And it's very cheap. It costs less than 3 American B-2 bombers. And the amount of goodness out of it will be wonderful.
Hey, thanks, thanks for the call, Edwin.
Thank you very much.
Good luck in your quest as well online.
Zan, I've broken somebody's heart on the Twitter homepage.
How so?
Papa Wheelie has said, I've just said that beer is 95% water. I've broken his heart.
Move on,
Papa Wheelie.
Dan here with you. Dr. Carl, for the last time in 2011, and a few answers that have come through on your favourite medium on the computer, Twitter, Dr. Carl.
Twitter.
What have you learnt?
Well, Bopopotamus tells me that, I quote, I once witnessed a Labrador, that's a dog, yelping in pain as it walked on some hot sand, full stop. Guess they do feel some pain. Yes, of course, everything feels pain. And, of course, about the ear thing, Cam Parker says that earbuds, with regard to the sound increasing, changing frequencies, you move them away. Earbuds are complicated. They are. You've got spatial effects of stereo. You've got bone conduction and even lack of competition with other outside background noises.
Thank you to those people who answered our questions for us on Twitter. Don't forget, you can follow Dr. Carl very easily, DOCTORKARL. Be one of the 102,000 people who learn from him every day on Twitter. Speaking of which, I mentioned just before that song that you were going to have some kind of involvement in the Large Hadron Collider, and Bergotastic just tweeted, oh dear, they're not going to be firing Dr. Carl around the Large Hadron Collider, are they? An amazing image to conjure with, but no, what are you going to be doing with the Large Hadron Collider?
Being a touristy type person and having a look at things, and there are various experiments there, and one of them, when I say experiments, these are these detectors. And gone are the days when the detector was something that you had on a bench top that was the size of a microwave oven. This one, there's a few of them there, and they're 4,000 tonnes in weight and 100 metres long and 30 metres in diameter, and they're huge and they're complicated, and they're cathedrals and they're one-off devices that have been made. They're so advanced that they're pushing science to the point where it becomes art. And one of them is named Alice, and I hope to get inside that with my daughter Alice. Hey, we named this one just for you because you're coming today. I'm going to tell her a little white lie.
So you're getting a tour of the Large Hadron Collider?
Little bits of it. You can't go underneath because there's all sorts of bad stuff, and the beam's off at the moment. The beam has, even though it's virtually invisible, you know, the thickness of a human hair, it has the energy of an express train.
Wow.
A couple of thousand tons. Oh, man. It's awesome.
We're going to hear about that next year, I'm sure. Dr. Carl heading off on some adventures, as he always does, very, very soon. Let's get into a few more questions before you escape the building, Carl. Chris is calling in from Ulladulla. Thanks so much for staying on the line, Chris. What's your question?
No problem. How are you going, Dr. Zan?
Thank you, Dr. Chris.
Just wondering, when you watch a movie and you see it, and there's an American actor in there, you don't actually notice their accent. But if there's an Australian in a movie, you notice their accent. So I'm just wondering, but when you go downtown, if there's an American downtown, you notice their American accent, but Australian, you don't. I'm just wondering, why do you notice their Australian accent so strongly in movies and not American accents? Well, when you're downtown, you notice their accent, American accent strong, but not the Australian accent.
Ah, I base this answer upon Xena the Warrior Princess, where I get all of my knowledge of anthropology and ancient human behaviour from. And in the past, as today, storytellers have a special place in our society. And being able to tell a story to somebody takes you into their mind space and you go floating away, and then suddenly you are there, even better than you are in reality. So when you're walking down the street and you hear the accents, it's different from being in a movie. I'll give an example of how different things are in a movie. If you get people who go to the movies and they regularly eat popcorn and they like their popcorn, you have them in a movie and you feed them some old popcorn. I mean old, stale, smelly, week-old popcorn. In the movie theatre, they have been hypnotised into this strange new land which has taken over their reality, like The Matrix, and they eat the stale popcorn. But if you show them the movie in a different setting, say in an office where you've got a little projection theatre or something like that that's not the same as your regular movie, suddenly they say, "What is this crap?" So my only answer is that there's something about the combination of the story and the deeply involving experience that a movie is. The sound, which is multi-way, not just mono or stereo, but you have five-way speakers, and the pictures, and it takes you in. Now, I'm sure that that's not the real answer, but it's a part of the step in that direction.
No problems.
Thanks for the call, Chris.
Thank you, guys. Have a good trip, Doctor.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Chris.
See you, mate.
Jason's calling in from Hobart this morning. He's off on a journey soon. Where are you headed, Jason?
I'm heading over to Morzine.
Going to where, sorry?
Morzine in France.
All right, nice. And what's your question for Dr. Carl?
I'm just wondering about the ways of reducing jet lag. I've heard NASA did some sort of experiment with some sort of drug or something.
There's a report on another part of the wide ABC panoply of science that we have. And I think this was by Robin Williams in the Science Hour, where he was talking with a guy who was involved with the discovery of melatonin, M-E-L-A-T-O-N-I-N. And from memory, and my memory's pretty bad, I think 30% of the astronauts on the space station take melatonin, because they're getting a sunrise and a sunset every hour and a half.
Jeez.
And the thing about melatonin is it hasn't been through all of the full clinical trials, so you sort of buy this illegally off the internet, or not illegally, but you buy it, boots and all, knowing that there could be risks, like your hand might fall off. Okay, that's really unlikely. And I'm kind of thinking that on this trip I might take some melatonin just to see if it will reduce the jet lag. I know a lot of people who do a lot of international travelling. I only do a little bit, and they swear by it. But I don't know what the long-term effects are. But if you try it just as a one-off hit, it might work. And it's almost idiosyncratic with jet lag. The last time I went over to Europe, I didn't have any going over. But coming back for about 2 weeks later, I was waking up at 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock. And, mate, when you suddenly wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning, you've got no control over that. You can control that you'll stay awake to some degree when the sun is up. Yes, I'll do the right thing. The sun is up, I'll stay awake. You can sort of control that unless you're really, really tired. But waking up wide awake at 2 o'clock in the morning, 2.5 weeks after you've come back from overseas, you've got no control over
that. So lonely at that time of morning as well. There's no one else around.
Yeah. Oh, except for your good friend, the internet.
That's true. Good luck, Jason. Have a great trip, mate.
Thanks very much.
See you later. Let's head to Doreen, where Dwayne's on the line. Hi, Dwayne.
Good morning, doctors. How are you?
Very well. What's your question?
I would like to know what the long-term effects would be of electromagnetics on the human body.
There's two sorts of electromagnetic radiation. There's ionising, which is definitely dangerous.
Yep.
And there's non-ionizing. Ionizing radiation gets that name because it creates ions. An ion is an atom, I-O-N. An ion is an atom that has had one or more electrons knocked off. And so X-rays, gamma rays, they're definitely dangerous, definitely have cancer-causing effects. It gets very difficult with non-ionizing radiation. You are buried in it. You are immersed in it. As you walk around, there are electromagnetic radiation non-ionizing from radio, television, radio transmitters from somebody around the corner, Wi-Fi units all over the place. After years of searching, we have found nothing. There might be further results further down the line, but at the moment, we have found no harmful effects.
Ah, okay. Not a problem.
Thanks for the call, Dwayne.
Okay, thanks, doctors.
Let's head to Albury, where Mitch is on the phone. Morning, Mitch.
Good morning.
What's your question for Dr. Carl?
I was told by one of my friends about a particle that could travel as fast or faster than the speed of light. They didn't know the name of it, and I just wanted to know if he was telling me porcupines. He said it was a recent development.
Porcupines.
Porcupines, lies, rhyming slang.
Adorable.
Yes. There are particles called neutrinos. They are not without mass. They have a very tiny, tiny mass. And a recent experiment done at, casual dropping in of gratuitous boasting, the Large Hadron Collider, where I'm going next week, close brackets, they ran some protons into a target and then picked up some neutrinos 700 and something kilometres away. And they then worked out the time for the neutrinos to fly there and the distance, divided one by the other, get the speed. Bingo! It's a tiny bit faster than the speed of light. Crazy! And the scientists did the right thing. They said, look, we found this a few years ago. We've been doing the experiment over and over, trying to find out where we made a mistake. We can't find a mistake. We're publishing what we did. We probably made a mistake. Find it for us. And then everybody said, well, we'll have a look. And so somebody's just done the experiment recently, and blow me down, they found the same effect. Now, it's a bit more complicated than that because how do you measure distance and time when you're dealing with a particle that hardly interacts with us at all? What do I mean by interact? Well, if you talk about X-rays and gamma rays, you can stop them with, you know, a millimetre of lead, a centimetre of lead, a metre of lead, 5 metres of lead. You can stop gamma rays and X-rays and that sort of ionising radiation if you really, really have to. To stop neutrinos, you need a few dozen light years of lead.
Jeepers.
I know. So they're really hard to pick up. There's untold billions of them going through all the time, and trying to pick up one is hard, and they've got techniques and blah, 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 blah. So it's still in that early stage where, on one hand, everybody wants to believe it's true because it will usher in the new physics, but everybody, like being good scientists, are saying, mate, it's a big ask. You know, extraordinary claim. You need extraordinary evidence. So people are trying to find mistakes. We haven't found the mistakes yet. We almost certainly will, but I hope we don't, but we probably will. And what it'll do is usher in the new physics, and what I reckon it will give us is zero transit time travel. You'll be able to go into another dimension and go from Australia to London, Australia to the moon in zero time.
Teleport.
That's a total guess. I've got no proof of that.
Thanks for the call, Mitch.
Thank
Great
you.
Question. And we're going to head to Derby. Is it Derby or is it Derby, Kev?
It's Key.
Ken. Sorry, Ken.
Key. It's the front door.
Key.
Oh,
sorry.
Key.
Yeah.
You know what?
How are you going, Dr. Zan,
the,
Dr. Carl?
The V and the Y on my screen looks very similar. Sorry about that, Key.
But how do you, is it the place where you get the 12 metre tides?
Yes, it's very massive tides up here.
Yeah, what do you call it? Place? Is it Derby or Derby? I've heard both. What do you call it?
Derby if you're from WA, Derby if you're from over east.
There you go.
Derby it is.
All right. What's your question, Key?
I have a bet going on with my boss. He thinks termites can eat asbestos. I don't think they can.
What happens with asbestos fibres is that they are exactly the right length to be not... First thing about asbestos fibres is they're very robust and are resistant to being broken down by the various chemicals available within the human body, both within the gut, within the lungs and within immune system cells. And secondly, they happen to be exactly the right length that they force the immune system cells to go into a friend and the other cells that wrap themselves around the fibres and they can't digest it and they go into a frenzy of dividing and dividing and dividing. So there's this fibre, they come along, they eat the fibre, bad fibre, doesn't belong here, they wrap themselves around it, they eat it, and then they think, wow, something's bad's going on, I can't digest it, and they, for some reason, they divide and divide and divide, and they divide so many times, not just say once every day, but once every few seconds, or yeah, but a lot more than normal, that inevitably you're going to get a cancer formed. I think that white ants and termites, which are two different creatures, if or any living creature that would eat asbestos would get some sort of equivalent of asbestosis, mesothelioma, cancer, whatever. I have no proof of this. We would need to know from an entomologist.
Oh, entomologists are dead to me. They never call.
They never call, especially the ones that we really want on this occasion, which are the oncotic entomologists, the ones dealing with cancers of the insects. Where are you when you want them on a Thursday morning?
Entomologists, I look to you in 2012 to call us just once. Hey, Key, yes, we'll see if we can get an entomologist on the line next year when we return. Thanks for the call, mate.
Right, thank you, Dr. Key.
See you later. John's calling in from Gaimea Bay this morning. Hi, John.
G'day, Dr. Carl and Dr. Zan. How are you this morning?
Well, what's your question, Dr. John?
It's very straightforward. With the discovery of the Kepler-22b planet that's roughly 2.5 times the size of Earth, admittedly they don't know the mass, debating with my 16-year-old daughter, the people, if they were similar inhabitants, would they be more squat, more solid, more dense, as not in intelligence, but as in their structure and their makeup compared to us with a lower gravity?
I would think yes. With regard to this planet, Kepler-22b, discovered by the Kepler satellite in orbit around the Earth, staring at a very small part of the Milky Way, looking at a bunch of stars, small number of stars, and looking for changes in brightness. Changes in brightness that happen at regular intervals of the same size. And in this case, Kepler-22b refers to a star pretty similar to our Sun, and on three occasions, almost a year apart, not quite but close enough, the brightness has suddenly gone down as this object, we think, goes across the front of it, and then it's done it about a year later and a year later. And so we're thinking almost certainly there is something that is orbiting around this star, and it is. Then we do all of the numbers and work out that it turns out to be in the so-called Goldilocks or habitable zone, not too close to the star, not too far away from the mother star, such that if you do the energy equations, the temperature is such that liquid water could exist. So now we've got a star that's similar to our Sun, and a planet that's not too different from ours, and it's in the habitable zone where liquid water can exist. That's all we know now. We need to have better technology to work out whether it actually has an atmosphere. But I would follow, in your family, the one who says, if there are creatures like us, they would be more squat.
Yes, I think that would probably be the case. I read on the Astrophysics Journal that they think its mean global temperature was 22 degrees centigrade. So
that's ideal. Well, to have life, you need the following factors. You need the right raw materials, and both the moon and the earth have those, hydrogen, oxygen, zinc, iron. You need energy from somewhere, and both the earth and the moon have those as well. We get the energy from the sun. The third factor you need are the three states of matter, solid, liquid, and gas. On the moon, all of the elements are locked in the rocks. But on Earth, they're flexible. They go from solid to liquid and gas around and around, and then you have life evolving. I would bet anybody a dollar that we'll find life there. I don't know how long it'll take to get there, though.
It'll probably take too long.
It's a great question to end up on the year. Thanks so much for being our final caller for 2011.
Thank you.
Good on you, John.
Bye-bye.
And a reminder, too, if you're going to miss Dr. Carl terribly, as I know we all are, he will be back mid-Feb 2012. But if you want to catch up on all of your science love, then you can do so. Just download a bunch of podcasts from the J website or check out drcarl.com, where there'll be special little Dr. Carl missives for the next couple of months as Dr. Carl heads off to, well, the Large Hadron Collider next week, and then you're going to go and crack off a bit of Antarctic ice into your scotch, Dr. Carl.
That's right, and also go into Iceland to hopefully see the aurora. And I'm now posting on the Twitter homepage the address of the eclipse. I am personally have arranged with God that there will be an eclipse over Australia as I fly out of Australia on Saturday night.
It's going to be a big one. I'm going to be at the Meredith Music Festival where Grinderman's set will be interrupted by the eclipse. Hopefully the rain will hold out and the clouds will clear for that one. A big thank you over the last year for the guy who, well, has been behind the scenes. If you think about how many calls come through every morning, think about all the calls that try to battle their way in just to get on the board. And that guy is Lockie Macara, our super producer who talks to you every week. Big thanks to Lockie for answering the phones. And to you, Dr. Carl, it's been a great week, or a great year indeed, of science. And we'll see you back in the chair in 2012.
I'm hanging out to be with you, my new best friend forever, Dr. Zan.
Thanks, Dr. Carl.